Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here this week once again with Alex Jordan, because Derek is in, I don't know, geography unknown, something like that. He won't tell me where he is, even though I've texted him over 400 times. But Alex, thank you again for joining me. Alex, of course, is a member of the Quincy Institute of Responsible Statecraft, and he's also the co-host of the upcoming Quincy show, Always at War. And just for, I know Prestige Heads are going to be interested in that. They've got some, I don't know if there are they secret interviews yet, Alex? Maybe we should leave people wanting more, but some big names are going to be, leave them hanging. some big names coming up on that show. So everybody keep your eye out for it. We'll definitely let you know when it debuts. But Alex, thank you so much for joining me once again to talk about the happiest news in the world.
You know it, man. I'm happy to be here. I'm sorry that Derek has been compromised to a permanent end.
Well, I send him a text every, 12 and a half minutes, and he just leaves me on red. So, but at least he's reading them. they just get increasingly desperate. Hello.
You get what you can. You can't ask for more than that.
No, you can't. But let's start off with the RSF, which has announced a parallel government in Sudan. So, Alex, why don't you tell us what's what's going on there?
Yeah, so I'll try not to start all of these with a deep sigh, but I think this one probably warrants it. Yeah, so the RSF has announced a parallel government in Sudan while it is pressing into this camp, the Zamzam camp near Al Fasher, which is in North Darfur. But so they've displaced, it sounds like, in the past couple of days, 400,000 people from this camp. After launching this assault, it's left more than 300 people dead, including at least 10 aid workers, according to the UN. And the coalition government, which is called the Government of Peace and Unity, has been in the works for a minute. They first announced RSF.
That was the original name of American Prestige. It was a podcast for peace and unity.
Well, you guys are achieving it. I think you've pretty much won it all.
Oh, thank you.
If I look around, I see all the peace you've brought us, and I appreciate it. But anyway, yeah, so the Government of Peace and Unity has been in the works for a while. It was first announced in February in Nairobi. The idea is this helps legitimize their cause. They're not necessarily internationally recognized, the RSF. But the idea of a parallel government is, it'll help them gain control of humanitarian aid flows from the countries that do support them. They can grow access to, arms markets, and generally would hypothetically help legitimize its territorial holdings and be a part of the leverage they'd have at a future peace negotiation. And the RSF already controls a lot of Western and Southern Sudan, and the military holds the North and the East. This is notable because, it suggests a durable peace is pretty far away. There have been times where more optimistic analysts have expressed, some hope over the last 2 years, because April will mark 2 years of this war, that maybe changing circumstances would put a potential endgame in sight. Like the SAF, the government forces, recently retook the capital city of Khartoum. So, you saw people hoping, oh, maybe this means something better. But a partition suggests the country will face a pretty fractious territorial split. And, that could not only intensify the war, but it creates new territory for expanded fighting. And so, like I mentioned, this has been 2 years now since the war between the Sudanese Armed Forces, which is the SAF, and the RSF, Rapid Support Forces. And this has, totally devastated the country. It's left more than 150,000 people dead and 12 million displaced. And over half the population is facing, pretty acute food insecurity. We've seen credible accusations of mass atrocities against both sides, and particularly the RSF in Darfur. And I think that's notable to, us American listeners, because the U.S. government itself believes that our close friends in the UAE are likely helping to arm the RSF. While the UAE stringently denies this, this is something the U.S. government has basically acknowledged behind closed doors, if not in public, because Biden just last year designated the UAE a quote major defense partner of the US. So, you know, I'm sure the next time that His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, also known as MBZ, next
friend
time
of the
he's
pot.
Visiting the White House or gets invited to South by Southwest, that he'll be grilled on, you know, subverting the liberal international order here by supporting the RSF. But I don't know.
I have no doubt. Before we move on to the next thing, just two quick things. It's Alex Jordan. I mistakenly said Jordan, like Michael Jordan, of course, the famous basketball
of course,
player.
Everybody knows Michael Jordan.
everybody loves him. And then Alex, in sort of a grim question, is there another concern about partition here? As happened in Sudan earlier, or is this just going to be one of those cold wars in like Kashmir that kind of go on forever, or is it too early to tell?
No, I think partition is like a live concern. In particular, as you said, this would be like returning to a prior history. You can imagine, you know, something like this parallel government being an excuse, and it already is for various countries to sort of weigh in on either side. Like we saw the Saudis just now, I'm not going to get the timeline right, but it was pretty recently, maybe within the last week, had said, okay, like we actually, you know, oppose what the RSF is doing, and we want to see, you know, some sort of peace process. Meanwhile, Kenya has agreed to support and host the RSF's new government in Nairobi. So, you know, as this parallel structure happens, it's easier for international actors to take sides. And now the partition government can take claims to the UN, or sorry, the parallel government. And so this just makes the conflict in some way like more durable. Like it's easy to imagine.
It has an institutional basis basically.
Which opens up arguably like more negative externalities, which is hard to say in like a pretty like desperate and dire situation already. So it's something definitely to be concerned about. And I think, unfortunately, there's not really an end in sight. So,
well, good news. Let's move on to the Iran-US negotiations, which have continued in Oman. And it does seem like, Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, the reporting suggests that like Trump pretty much told Netanyahu that Israel shouldn't attack Iran, right? And that he's going to make a deal. That's like the recent reporting. Is that correct? And then we could tell me about what's going on in the actual negotiations.
Yeah. So during his White House visit last week, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu basically like continued this effort to urge Trump to like, hey, let's forget about diplomacy. Let's do this thing. Let's finish the job. Let's strike Iran's nuclear facilities. And Trump has, to his credit, resisted this. And I think the best explanation is basically like Israel does not have the capability militarily to do the kind of damage they want to in a preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear programs. Like only the U.S. has the capability to damage some of Iran's more well-fortified sites. And we would use like our 30,000 pound bunker buster bomb to do that. And so Israel would effectively rely on the US to even successfully carry out this first strike. And it would rely on the US to help defend itself from Iranian retaliation to such an attack, which there certainly would be, particularly because the US would be involved this time. And this would, there'd be alarm bells ringing in Tehran, presumably. And even if this attack succeeded, the one that Bibi is pitching, the Israel-US joint attack, preemptive attack on Iranian nuclear facilities, the optimistic estimate is that this would only set Iran's path to the bomb back by a year, given that they've distributed their facilities and materials throughout the country to avoid vulnerability to this kind of thing. So, you know, Netanyahu is asking Trump, please help us do this first strike. Please defend against the retaliation. And also, after this first strike is done, you're going to be responsible for basically doing endless airstrikes on Iran to keep them from ever approaching a nuclear bomb. So it's effectively an ask for the U.S. to enter into this new forever war in the Middle East with Iran. And, you know, I think there's a lot of things you can say about Trump, but he does have he more than most politicians seems to have internalized an aversion, at least politically, to like to how Americans think about the post 9/11 wars a little bit. And so I think there is a part of him and like an instinct there, and certainly within like parts of his team, to avoid this kind of war. And so presumably, like, looking at what the reality of what Israel is really asking, which is like, take up this plan to effectively do a final, I mean, not decapitation strike, but do a final full-scale strike that sets Iran back and help us, you know, help us keep a boot on their nuclear ambitions forever. That's certainly a lot to ask. And so Trump instead seems to actually want to try out negotiations first. He told Bibi apparently on Monday, no, I want to see what negotiations do for me. And so we have this new set of negotiations in Oman this weekend after a successful first round of talks. It was pretty remarkable. Like Iranian Foreign Minister Araghchi, he agreed to speak directly to Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, like very briefly towards the end of the talks, I think. And, you know, Iranians never agreed to meet U.S. officials at a foreign ministry level under Biden. They didn't have much belief that Biden really wanted a deal after he sort of slow walked. After he got into office, he like slow walked any approach to a nuclear deal and, you know, said he wanted something longer and stronger, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, they're open to, and they seem to think that Trump has reasons to want this. And I think I mentioned last week, you know, they're appealing for sanctions relief, would do all these things for U.S. businesses, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, as long as Trump's team sticks with this verification-based approach, you know, verifiably limiting Iran below a certain enrichment threshold, I think there's like pretty good reason to think that this might work. But it is worth saying that there is like plenty of pressure on Trump to push a more maximalist direction here. You know, some around him are calling for Trump to pursue the total dismantlement of Iran's nuclear program, which is a total non-starter for Tehran. And, you know, hawks in Washington are basically arguing that there's no better time to go to a war with Iran after Israel's war in Gaza and with Hezbollah. And, you know, the idea is that basically Iran has a weak card right now because Hezbollah's power is diminished. Iran's defense stocks are diminished after the back and forth they had with Israel. So, you know, you see think tank reports about like, I'm not saying if it's good or bad to go to war with Iran, but if you were going to do it, this is how I'd do it. But it's that If I Did It book, I guess.
By OJ.
Yeah, If I Did It, the Iran War Edition. But so, yeah, there's apparently also a split in the administration. Axios was reporting yesterday that you have on the one end Rubio and Waltz, so Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor, who are pushing a more like hawkish approach and say, you know, you can't sit across the table from Iran, or you can't really trust what they're saying. You know, the standard, what was for years, the standard Republican line on Iran, particularly since the JCPOA. And then you have this like, you know, newly thinking or like differently thinking faction within Trump's administration now, which is like J.D. Vance, Tulsi Gabbard, apparently even Susie Wiles, Trump's chief of staff, who like think that the time is right for diplomacy and that there's a deal here that they can get that would prevent Iran's path to a nuclear weapon and, you know, avoid the possibility, the probability, what you may call it, of going to war with Iran on Israel's behalf. So, you know, we'll see. I think Iranians have a lot of reasons to be relatively skeptical of Trump's intentions. You know, after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani in the first term, you know, so there is this chance of breakdown in talks if Trump goes in there with all these new demands and sort of scares off Iranians from thinking that there's an opportunity for a deal here. But signals are like surprisingly decent right now. So this is the ray of sunshine I will hold on to, the idea of like, maybe we don't have to go to a war with Iran while we're doing 18 other you know, wars and interventions elsewhere or whatever. So yeah, we'll see. But
we will see. And let's talking about talks. Let's talk about these U.S. Saudi talks about giving the Saudis nuclear technology.
Yeah, doesn't this sound great?
I see no problems.
Yeah, I see no issues with this. So the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are on a pathway to a nuclear cooperation agreement. So that would mean America helping the Saudis set up a civil nuclear program. In theory, this would be subject to what's called a 1-2-3 agreement, which is required under U.S. law. It's meant to basically guard against proliferation. You're sharing this technology, but you're, you know, placing these limitations that would keep it from being used to develop a bomb. But it's important to note the Saudis have not like actually signaled that they want to do this subject to a 1-2-3 agreement. They've like publicly resisted making commitments around uranium enrichment or spent fuel reprocessing. So it remains to be seen like how the actual deal would work out, and we'll want to see that. But you know, don't you love the idea of a nuclear MBS? Because like you should start thinking about it.
Another friend of the pod. I mean, like this clearly seems related to this broader Trump strategy in the Middle East, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So this is like the nuclear technology, civil nuclear technology has long been one of the reported Saudi like gets from a potential normalization deal with Israel. Saudi-Israeli normalization was pursued under Biden. Biden did not pull anything off there, and now it's a part of Trump's strategy. Biden's team posited that this normalization between Saudi and Israel would be like akin to a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But like, if you dig down deeper into the terms, it doesn't follow, because it is much more likely to look like the Abraham Accords, which was the UAE-Israel and the Israel-Bahrain normalization deal that Trump and Jared Kushner pursued in the first term and achieved. And this deal was basically like premised on normalization and sidelining the question of Palestinian self-determination for good. So if a normalization deal were to occur under Trump, you know, you would want it to establish some sort of durable regional security architecture where like the states in the region are interacting with each other rather than like using the U.S., playing off the U.S. You would want to see it end the Israeli occupation. You'd want to see the creation of a Palestinian state. If you see those things, sure. Like, let's talk. You could even imagine if all those things happen, how you could talk yourself into, okay, like a limited civil nuclear sharing agreement, you know, as part of this process that creates a Palestinian state. But I think that's the optimistic version of this, because I think there's a pretty decent, it's not like the U.S. is like suddenly super, super concerned with pursuing self-determination for Palestinians. Like, it seems much more likely that a deal would obligate the U.S. to go to war against like whoever Saudi Arabia is mad at. It would give them nuclear technology potentially without limits to keep them from developing a weapon, and, you know, most likely do some sort of mumbling about Palestinian aspirations for a statehood without making serious commitments. And so if it looks like that, that's like a big, terrible deal for the U.S. And like, I think probably what's like deserves more attention is just, yeah, the idea that the U.S. would go to war for Saudi Arabia. Like, that's such a crazy commitment. Like, you know, we don't even have a commitment to all these other allies, or not allies, but like all these other friends.
Partners.
Yes.
Friends and partners. Yeah.
but that would be a next level commitment. And the Saudis have got a lot of enemies in the region, and like maybe not the most prudent leaders on the global stage. Just judging by like, you know, the slaughter that they authored in Yemen, or name any number of things. So yeah, there's a lot to be concerned about how a normalization deal would actually impact the U.S. approach here.
Good news all around. Yeah. Let's move on to this trade war, which is probably what most of our listeners are aware of. But so what's going on between the U.S. and China and this war that seems not to be ending anytime soon?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, there was Liberation Day and then the Liberation Day sort of walkbacks, and that in effect means Trump imposed these wide global tariffs and then paused most of them, and except for everything on China, and just dives, you know, headfirst into this U.S.-China trade war. But even just in the last week, since the sort of reversal on tariffs, if you will, Trump has like further sort of like scaled back ambitions in some regards. Like, he paused, you know, taxes on electronics imported into the U.S. last week, you know, this week. So that would have been, I think that was Friday. But, you know, that was a big concern. We were talking about expensive iPhone. We don't have to worry about expensive iPhone anymore because Trump is, you know, watching out for companies, companies like Apple dealing with the technological imports. But we're still staring at these like huge tariff levels, 145% tariff on China and the US, 125% Chinese retaliatory tariff. And there's a like good bit of product by product retaliation going now. Like Trump, you know, says, hey, U.S. government, we have to review all the rare earth minerals that we're getting in our supply chain from China. And China says, hey, you know, Chinese companies, stop ordering things from Boeing. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of sort of who blinks first analysis, which, I mean, that's kind of like an optimistic scenario that we get one of these that China or the U.S. blinks. Particularly because like China's got a decent hand here, as I talked about last week. And if Trump doesn't blink, he could find himself on the losing end of this. And then like, what's the off ramp as you go on this tit for tat? I mean, I saw the White House, I think, threatened 100% increase in tariffs. They threatened to bring the tariff rate to 245%, which China basically like waved off as like, that's, what are you talking about? Like, we're not even going to like threaten back. That's hard to imagine. Or I don't know.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah.
But again, I think this is sort of how I framed it last week is like, when it comes to these kind of conflicts that become, you know, zero sum, any win for them is a loss for us. You really have to try and imagine what the off ramps are going to be. Like, either one party has to be like more responsible and sort of say, I'm not interested in going down this spiraling path, or, you know, both sides have a lot of reasons to see that their best path is to make this harder on the other. So, you know, all of that said, Beijing seems to still be sending signals that it does not really want the mutually painful decoupling. Like, it did not happen on their terms. Like, Trump absolutely push this into action. You know, they've asked the U.S. to stop insulting China because J.D. Vance made a flip remark about Chinese peasants. They want a point person in the U.S. government they can talk to. They don't like, I guess, all these different messages of different qualities coming from all these different levels. You know, you get the sense that China wants to, you know, again, see where an opportunity could be to have some sort of talk. And Trump still, you know, says, oh, I want talks, but they need to get serious about our problems. And so, you know, there are okay signals, but day by day, as more pain is inflicted, I think there's just, yeah, the serious risk that both sides sort of bunker down in their logic. And I think I've seen plenty of arguments and they seem relatively persuasive that if we're heading into a trade war, China has got something of an upper hand.
And I think like this might be a good time to talk about Xi's visit around, yes, Southeast Asia. So what's going on there?
Yeah, speaking of China's relatively strong hand, Xi sort of is demonstrating as much. He went on this quick little tour through Southeast Asia. He went to Vietnam, Malaysia, and Cambodia, which are all countries that have major trade relationships with China. And this is sort of a show of force in response to the trade war that, you know, China has options. If it can't rely on U.S. demand, it can increase domestic demand. It can strike new trade agreements bilaterally with all of the partners in the region. And, you know, that it has options, basically, that Trump is trying to cow China and say, but China is saying, we've got like a pretty decent hand here. And that fits with how we understand their economy. And there was some reporting this week, you know, that Trump is explicitly asking friendly nations in the region to choose sides. And that's like bad and counterproductive when you look at countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, or Cambodia that have these like deep bilateral ties, trade ties, you know, all sorts of connection to China. It's hard to imagine that they take kindly, and we know they don't take kindly to being asked to take sides. And if they are forced to take sides in the context of a trade war, there's decent reason to think that they would not take the quote unquote American side. So, you know, I guess I would take the talker's privilege here, the Derek privilege, to just note that like the choosing sides part of this, which is bad and like stupid, was the implicit demand of the Biden administration. This does not arise from Trump alone. Like, we know this because we heard from diplomats in various global South countries, in Brazil and Singapore, you know, you name it, that this was the message from Biden, that we are building this coalition, this containment coalition, to limit China's ambitions and limit its, you know, limit the threat it poses to the liberal international order by asking these different countries that have significant ties with China to step back and to, like, join the US in effectively, yeah, containing China's you know, what is approaching, or what, you know, regional hegemony, if you will. Because, you know, for the US, it does not like to see spheres of influences and that other countries have. And so,
yeah, that
so,
it doesn't control. Yeah.
Yeah. So effectively, like, you know, Trump's, you know, trying to force these countries to choose, countries that, like, if they were forced to choose, wouldn't necessarily choose the US. You know, this move, it emanates from a bipartisan logic. This is not to excuse what Trump is doing. It is just to explain that, like, Biden created and helped build this logic that this was going to be the approach, that if we were going, you know, if the US and China were zero-sum competitors, it would require peeling off these various countries in Southeast Asia to be the bulwark of American interest and in this growing competition. And so, you know, Trump's here, you know, the move is definitely more potentially explosive and destructive than what Biden was doing, because it's happening in the context of an escalating trade war where economic effects are already being felt. But I think it's important to note just that, like, the US-China, you know, pretty awful trade war opportunity, or not opportunities, like, some of the negative externalities here were created and made possible by the building over this last many years, from Trump 1 to Biden to Trump 2, this logic of, you know, China is a geopolitical rival, you know, that there's not an opportunity for renegotiating our relationship or our understanding, renegotiating sort of the global economic order that the US and China are, you know, at the head of. You know, this is not a renegotiation. This is everybody sort of going into their bunkers.
Yeah, just aggression. Yeah. Like, it's almost like trench warfare. Well, let's talk about former nightclub owner Nayib Bukele's visits to the White House.
Wait, hold on now. Former nightclub owner?
Yeah, my understanding is he ran a nightclub and a Yamaha dealership. So basically, my three major interests: night dancing, Yamahas, and geopolitics. So, you know, I get it.
Oh, great. Well, maybe yeah, he's taken his White House friends out dancing when they come visit or whatever.
Imagine Trump at the club.
Yeah. Oh, man. We know he's got a couple dance moves out there. We've seen him.
Yeah,
on
that's
stage.
Stupid. Yeah. Dance moves. Yeah. Oh, my God.
But anyway, so Bukele was in the White House this week, you know, talking about the US-El Salvadorian relationship, where he's asked by a journalist about the status of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, who was the Maryland man who was deported to El Salvador on accusations that he had ties to the MS-13 gang. You know, Bukele basically said he was powerless to return Garcia, which, like, doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of how we understand this deportation going down. And a federal judge just this week has found probable cause to hold the administration in criminal contempt for defying his order that the administration, like, stop the transfer of deportees to El Salvador. And the Supreme Court ruled last week that the government must, quote, facilitate Garcia's release from the prison. But you sort of get to the, like, how many divisions does the Supreme Court have thing? How many divisions does the Pope have? So, like,
right. Andrew Jackson said something similar, I think, about the Indian Removal Act in 1830, where he was ruled against it. He said, okay, let them enforce it.
Exactly.
But this doesn't really happen often in American history. It's 200 years ago. But right. So this is pretty bad And my understanding is that the court would have sanctioning power. They could essentially, like, levy fines and things like that. But yeah, it's going to be, if the executive branch just totally decides to ignore a court order, that doesn't get us into a good situation, is my understanding.
No, I think that's right. And it's not like I think they have marshals at the court. The Supreme Court has marshals, but it's not like they're going to go send like a battalion of Supreme Court soldiers down to El Salvador to bring Garcia back. It's a serious concern. And I think something more concerning or relatedly concerning is that there was new reporting this week that suggests that El Salvador is planning to double the size of CECOT, which is already the world's largest prison. This is where these deportees are being held. And this would be to accommodate more people that were deported from America or people who were arrested and imprisoned in America and then sent to El Salvador for reasons. Again, the logic does not follow here. But, you know, El Salvador already has the world's highest incarceration rate. American is fifth, you know. So I think that I think you can see a real like alignment of values here.
Yeah, elective affinities.
Yes. So that would imagine that this like seems like a very live possibility. And yeah, that both governments have an affinity for, you know, wanting to move people who we don't like into these incarcerated spaces that exist outside of our consideration. Like that's an old like a prison abolitionist point or whatever, but like you put somebody in prison, it brings them outside of the consideration, the consciousness, or even the shape of a nation. They're just in this like third space.
Speaking of arresting and detention, let's talk about the continuing arrest and detention of pro-Palestine voices. So, Alex, what's recently happened there?
Yeah, Mohsen Madawi, who's a Palestinian legal U.S. resident, was arrested by ICE on the 14th at a Vermont immigration office where he had gone for a citizenship interview. And so his legal team has filed a habeas petition. They're challenging the detention. A Vermont judge has issued a temporary restraining order. I think the goal there, or not the goal, but I think the effect would be Madawi would not be sent to Louisiana, where some of these other pro-Palestinian voices had been sort of are being held while the government figures out, you know, what their argument is and how they can move forward with trying to punish these folks for pro-Palestinian speech. And so, you know, this arrest follows, of course, Mahmoud Khalil, who's being held at that facility in Louisiana. Oz Turk, I'm forgetting her first name, but to the graduate, the PhD at Tufts University. So yeah, this continues apace. It is absolutely something to be concerned about. And, you know, pro-Palestinian speech, particularly at the university, it seems, is like a pretty significant target for this administration. And unfortunately, they have reason to think that the executive's broad national security prerogatives might allow them to succeed in part on this effort to quell this speech. So very concerning.
Yeah, certainly concerning. Let's move on to Ecuador, where the center-right president, Daniel Noboa, has won re-election. So what's going on there, Alex?
Yeah, sure. So Noboa has won re-election in a runoff on Sunday. Noboa, you might know him from his new strategic alliance with friend of the pod, Eric Prince, in the fight against narco-terrorism. He's also the heir of a banana industry fortune. Don't know if he has any nightclubs, however. But yeah, so
probably he's personal experience, if not business experience, in nightclubs.
You'd think. So yeah, he declared a state of emergency on the eve of the vote, barring protests and authorizing warrantless searches of Ecuadorians. And his rival here in the election, Luisa Gonzalez, is challenging the election results after she ended this round of voting with a tally like nearly identical, as I understand it, to the first round. And this is despite she picked up the endorsement of an indigenous candidate, Isa, who had won like 5% in that first round and dropped out. So you might expect that she would have gained some of that support, but it didn't happen. And like I said, it was a wider margin than expected. So I'm seeing like people I trust ask questions here, but as you know how it goes with like contested elections, it's very hard to say with much certainty, particularly in the immediate aftermath. But Noboa is being recognized by various governments, and so presumably will indeed succeed in having been reelected. And Gonzalez's challenge to the results is not necessarily expected to succeed.
Let's move on to Ukraine, where Trump envoy Steve Witkoff has met with Putin, and he says we're on the verge of a deal. So, Alex, are we on the verge of a deal?
I think that's, he's being a little more optimistic than we have reason to believe, because, so, you know, I think it is good and is worth saying, like, America to successfully pursue peace deals in the end of conflicts, it should talk to people, even people we don't like or people we disagree with, like Putin. Like, it is, ending this war will require understanding what Russia wants or needs, what it will require to get them to stop this invasion and stop this war, right? And you have to first understand that to construct a deal that it's in all sides' mutual best interest to adhere to. So, you know, good that they're talking. And Steve Witkoff has got a busy portfolio of diplomacy these days. But despite, you know, saying we're on the verge of the deal, I think that the signals from Europe and particularly Kiev are like not so optimistic. It does not seem like Ukraine is ready for some of the initial offers that are on the table. And, you know, I think that there was, so there's this Russian attack on an apparent military ceremony in Sumy that killed 30. You know, Russia claims it was a military ceremony, and there's some reporting now from inside of Ukraine that I think the person responsible for holding the ceremony was fired. But, you know, 30 dead, it seems like definitely some civilians in there, reminiscent of a earlier attack in Kramatorsk, I believe is how you pronounce it, where, you know, Russia struck a place where there were some military officials, but also plenty of civilians. So, like, certainly raises very fair questions about proportionality that you would raise when at any time somebody, you know, kills 5 military people but 25 civilians. I'm not saying that's what the ratio is, but, you know, I think it's, Ukraine has got perfectly fair objections to, you know, these sort of attacks, but
absolutely,
you know, but it is not as clear cut as like some of the other, you know, straight Russian attacks that killed plenty of Ukrainians, where there was no conceivable logic that Russia could hide behind, if you will. But all that is to say that, you know, the Russia has not, they've still adhered to this, 30-day pledge to not attack certain energy infrastructure, as I understand it. But that 30-day window is closing. Ukrainians are very upset about the attack in Sumy. And, you know, you can just see the recipe for how a deal remains tough, which is that, you know, Russia keeps killing Ukrainians. Ukrainians keep retaliating as they can. Both sides, you know, feel, particularly Russia, feels that it has the upper hand now. Ukraine, and particularly Zelensky, can't stomach the domestic consequences of you know, his political career would potentially be over if he tried to negotiate a deal. So, you know, Zelensky went on 60 Minutes this past weekend and said that J.D. Vance was justifying Putin's invasion. White House is very upset by those comments. It's just not clear that the Trump administration is like, they now are on a various diplomatic paths, and I'm not in their team, but it seems like there's going to be a lot of work to bringing Kiev to be okay with some sort of settlement, bringing Europe to agree to be a partner to the sort of new European security architecture that would be inclusive of Russia, which is sort of what you could imagine a deal like this eventual deal might take. You know, Europe would have to take a broader role and, you know, guaranteeing Ukraine's defense and sovereignty. And so that you just get the sense that it's, you know, Russia is far from where it needs to be, but also the European Union and Kiev are not ready to like swallow a very bitter pill. And these are, you know, this is why, again, for years that like people warned about this sort of frozen or longstanding grinding conflict, which is the longer this war goes on, the more people that die, the more the cost that has been incurred by these countries, it is going to be a more bitter pill to swallow to end this war, particularly on terms that month by month are less advantageous to Ukraine. And so you have to have, or I don't say you have, like one has extraordinary sympathy with Ukrainians who have seen this country just decimated by this invasion and have seen all these millions flee and have encountered a lot of death and destruction. And you just hope that the Ukrainian government is like accurately representing the will of the people, which like plenty of polls show like do have an appetite for this war to end. And
one would imagine.
Yeah. So, you know, that remains, God, I would like need to come up with a nice, cool thing to say at the end of another like awful, depressing news story. I think that's the cool thing I say at the end, as I just note, isn't this depressing?
And yet we should have Jake insert like, you know, a goofy sound, like a spring sound or like a pop.
I was just going to say the boing spring.
Yeah, Jake, insert a boing. What about this whole Zelensky thing, though, on 60 Minutes?
Yeah, you know, I think the most charitable reading that I have of it is that he's appealing to like the American public and the European government.
We'll say what he did so that people who might not.
Yeah, sure. So he went on 60 Minutes and, he talked about the recent awful missile strikes in Ukraine. I think he mentioned the one on that had hit like a playground. He just sort of made Ukraine's case about like why it's hard to sit down and make peace with this like monstrous Putin, which like, again, we understand where they're coming from here, but this has been the line for a long time. And part of sort of the Trump administration's demand here clearly is that like you guys show that you are coming to the table on this stuff. And instead, Zelensky is saying, like, it's hard to imagine coming to the table. And when, you know, J.D. Vance, I think let me find the specific quote here. So Zelensky, you know, said that Vance is justifying Putin's actions. And I think the White House is pretty upset by this. And you saw Trump this week even suggest that, like, you know, Ukraine started this war. And I don't think Trump is saying this out of sort of like a Kennan-esque long point
strategic
about NATO expansion and like and Russia's perceived security threats or whatever. Like he's not making like the argument that about, you know, where does responsibility really lie for like creating, fomenting the ground for this crisis. I think it's just sort of like this is a bit of criminology, but he's just trying to say, like, I'm annoyed with all of you guys. Like, I'm annoyed with Russia. You guys keep killing Ukrainians and doing these, you know, I think Trump called the most recent strike terrible. He's annoyed with Ukraine that it isn't meeting the terms that they want. And it isn't showing the willingness that it wants. If so Zelensky says that Vance is justifying Putin's actions. Trump strikes back. And these are just the sort of like poisonous dynamics that can lose the trust that's going to be required to get to a deal here. So not a lot of great signs there.
No, not very good. All right, let's turn to Israel Katz, Israel's defense minister, who has said that the war in Gaza will escalate. So Alex, just tell us what's going on.
Yeah, an escalation in Gaza. It's like hard to imagine the escalation beyond genocide, right? Like, but yeah, so Israel Katz is saying that if Hamas doesn't release hostages that it still holds, that Israel will escalate with, quote, tremendous force and impose a humanitarian blockade. You know, this comes as ceasefire negotiations have stalled out after Israel, you know, effectively broke the ceasefire with a series of attacks. And it's just generally day by day, more and more headlines of these sort of bombings that are killing scores of Palestinians. And so Israel Katz also said, as a part of, I think this is a press conference, but he was making public remarks that Israeli troops would remain in the what they refer to as security zones in Gaza, Syria, and Lebanon, quote, in any temporary or permanent situation. So basically sort of laying the groundwork for this permanent, you know, aggressive footprint for Israel. I mean, aggressive is one way of putting it, but like that they would stay in Gaza indefinitely to facilitate the forced removal of Palestinians in Gaza, and then presumably in Syria, you know, as a counterweight to the government, and in Lebanon to deter Hezbollah. And, you know, in effect for each of these things, it's just about, you know, projecting Israeli military power to pursue what it sees as its interest here. But a lot of people killed and oppressed in the interim. And, you know, Israel Katz also said, you know, that they would be trying to destroy Hamas bunkers, both above and below ground, and continue evacuations until hostages are returned. Of course, you know, destroying Gaza more and more, in particular places where hostages might be held, seems like relatively antithetical to the idea of returning these people home safely. You know, and then Israel Katz also threatened that if Hamas persists in refusing to return hostages, that Israel's, quote, activity will expand and move to the next stages. So, you know, these are a part of all number of signals about Israel's intent to move forward with its maximalist ambitions, both in Gaza and more broadly in the region. And so, yeah, a lot to be concerned about this week, man.
Always, Alex. Well, thank you again for joining us. Everyone, don't forget to check out Alex's upcoming show that he co-hosts with Courtney Rawlings from the Quincy Institute of Responsible Statecraft, titled Always at War. I learned it'll be debuting in April, on April 30th. Is that what we decided? Late April?
We'll see the exact date, but we know, yeah, I know you guys will
help it. Promote.
Yes, certainly. I would love for everybody's help promoting,
we'll help promote.
Listen and watch. And Danny, we'd love to have you on Derek on sometime.
I don't know. I have a pretty big writer, but yeah, we'll talk. And everyone listening, please stay on to check out my interview with Afif Nasuli, who is a humanitarian aid worker on the ground in Gaza. And Alex, thank you again for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Danny. My pleasure.
When it comes to fungicides, there's only one way to spell yield. N-E-O. Miravis Neo is the 2024 number one retailer recommended corn fungicide for a reason. It dominates spots, rots, blights, and stress to out-yield competitive brands like Veltima. And there's 6 years of university data to prove it. Ask your Syngenta retailer about using Miravis Neo for more yield more often. Based on 2024 Stratus Retailer Efficacy Study. Always read and follow label instructions.
Hello, everyone. This is Danny again. Thanks for listening to the news, but we're going to bring you something that I think is really important. I'm now talking with Afif Nasuli, who is a humanitarian aid worker in Gaza. Afif, thank you so much for joining the show. Really, really appreciate you taking the time in these incredibly difficult circumstances.
No, I really appreciate you having me on, and I'm just honored to be here and also honored to tell people about it. So thank you.
No, of course. I'm genuinely honored that you are doing something that I think most people wouldn't do. And it's an incredible, just incredible. And there's nothing really more to say. So Afif, why don't we just get into the situation? What is the situation on the ground? What are you doing? And then you could take that in any direction that you would like.
Totally. So I am here on a medical rotation. I'm not a doctor or a nurse. I'm doing logistics coordinating, which is basically helping everyone in the medical, the emergency medical sort of team sphere, either getting case files, documenting things. Sometimes it's driving things to and fro, you know, to the hospital and staying at the hospital for a while, and basically shadowing doctors in their work. And I'm in Deir el-Balah right now. Earlier today, I was in Khan Yunis. we have doctors here that are set up at a hospital in Deir el-Balah and also at Nasser in Khan Yunus. And yeah, I'm here on a month rotation. I wish I could stay, but I will have to leave at some point. And the situation is very bad. Missiles all the time. Deir el-Balah was struck the other day. I was in the north over the weekend, and Al-Ahli Hospital was bombed. I'm sorry if there's a lot of noise in the background. I'm just in the actual, like, I'm outside in Gaza. So
how dare you? No, just kidding. It's totally fine. Right.
And there's music on, and people are, you know, finding whatever kind of relief they can, because there's drones constantly. There's constantly missiles and bombs in the background. There's a lot of violence that you just sort of have to detach yourself from. And the people here are really, really, really just strong people. And so it rubs off.
I can only imagine it's dealing with genuine terror constantly. So many people obviously listening have been paying attention to what's going on. What have you noticed that you might not necessarily see if you're just watching it on TV or seeing social media clips?
I think a lot of times we take people's stories from Gaza at the end of their story. I think we've been really here at a horrible, we've all just sort of, not all of us, but many of us have just clocked in at the very sort of end of many people's lives. And I think that what's really important for me to show off in every way that I can with these interviews is actually that there's extreme deprivation of a lot of things: food, healthcare, safety, hope in some ways. But it's important to understand that there was a lot of things that have been taken and stolen. And so Gaza isn't defined by like what's happening to it right now. It's a beautiful place with people who are extremely grateful in ways because of their religion or their spirituality. And what you would never see is the fact that this place existed and still exists as part and as removed from Israel's occupation of it. It's internationally criminal because it's full of life and full of families and full of love, and so much is being stolen. So I think that that's really hard to convey in news clips. And, you know, it's not sensational to say that, but it is striking how little we think about it.
How are people going about their daily lives in a situation that basically mitigates against the quotidian human existence that we all ultimately want to have? How are people coping with this terror? How are they coming together as a community?
They are honestly they're so communal and community driven that it looks a lot like making whatever food there is left together and eating it together. Trying to find a way to just be together and pass the time. And honestly, there's so much laughter and so much joking in between, also a lot of tears and grief that are just also just happening everywhere. But I think that it's important that the grief highlights the life instead of sort of maybe the other way around, I guess. And people are building things out of nothing and solving problems with such little resources. You're just sort of amazed at like, oh, we need to build this like outhouse, or we need to make a meal out of like this very little amount of food. Like, you're just blown away with the thankfulness as well. I think it's a bit about religiosity and Islam itself. Being Muslim is just having a lot of faith and really submitting. And, you know, I was raised Muslim, but I'm not very religious. And it's been a real interesting, it's just been so interesting to experience that level of spirituality and what it does for you when everything seems hopeless, because it really does allow these people to have faith in God in a bigger story, in a story that isn't just about this, even if there's so much loss, including family and friends.
Are people coming together in prayer groups? Like, I'm actually quite...
Yeah, like literally.
What is the mechanism of this religiosity and the spirituality in the face of so much destruction and death?
Oh, it's woven in the most basic ways people speak to each other. The way that Arabic is chock full of faithfulness. It's just poetry, really. Like, you walk into a room and you just say, may God bless you, like, or like, you know what I mean? Like, you're just literally, everything is like thankfully. When you're done eating, when you are saying goodbye, you're like, may God bring you peace. Like, it's just all really interwoven. And it's not really religiosity as it is just like culture as well, just the culture of like being really connected to God at all times as a way to just feel better about what's going on and having some sort of mechanism to just forget that everything is bad so that you can just like, I don't know, believe in something bigger than your pain. And it's really, I mean, obviously it's a little trite to say, but it's really inspiring.
I mean, absolutely. It is what human beings could do in the most terrible circumstances. Well, I mean, it's genuinely inspiring our resilience. What is the situation of aid? And what have you experienced as a humanitarian aid worker? And maybe you could let people know, like, what is that like and going through that as a person coming in?
Yeah. I got in and thought about coming with GLIA, which is a medical organization I'm working with, because I was trying to coordinate medication to a guy in the north for the last year who has HIV. And getting medication to him was always already hard. However, very unbeknownst or very like, what is that phrase? Like opposite from popular belief or whatever. I can't remember that phrase, but like, you wouldn't believe that the Ministry of Health, the Palestinian Ministry of Health, was supplying him as often as they could with HIV medication. And they were always saying, listen, like the depot might get destroyed, but this very religious institution, all of the institutions are run by the government, which is Hamas. And they are providing this HIV patient with months of medication, knowing and giving him messages of like solidarity. So now I came when the ceasefire broke, nothing is being let in. Doctors that I'm working with are working with, like they're working against the amount of people coming in and the not enough supplies. Like, so people are dying and they're having to make choices. I think you've probably heard this kind of story, but I just met someone, a colleague of a person I'm working with, who had to basically make a choice because they only had one thing to, you know, like a tourniquet, and someone was suffering here and suffering right in front of you, and you just have to make a call that's literally like, who has a better chance? And those things shouldn't ever happen. Like, that doesn't have to happen. Like, these people are dying of shrapnel wounds and burns and like internal organs combusting because of the huge amount of intensity of strikes. Like, and some of them are burning alive, and I don't mean to be extremely graphic, but it is graphic. And the amount of aid that's not being let in is also affecting the recovery of possible recovery of people that in another circumstance, which they wouldn't even have the injury to begin with, they're now dying from injuries that are also, you know, being affected by bacteria and a lack of gauze. Like, just, you know, it's just obviously something that's hard to put in words because it's so overwhelming. There's so much to talk about. But yeah, I mean, it's just people having to be resourceful because they have no resources.
What is the literal medical situation? Like, if we're thinking in the United States, there's a hospital and people are in a room in the hospital. What does it look like on the ground in Gaza?
You walk in to, say there's a mass casualty event, which happens every few days at this point. It's in usually one place. There's, you know, bombs happening and people going to the hospitals all the time. You walk into a hospital after a mass casualty event, it's people all over the place, all up the stairs, like people with wounds being laid down on the floor because all the beds are taken. It's like there's not enough painkillers. Like, mothers are, you know, having shrapnel in their breasts and affecting the milk duds. Like, it's stuff that is so unbelievably unfortunate and unnecessary that you're just flabbergasted because these doctors also have to just like work so hard because more are coming. And it's almost like, it's just like the local staff needs help. You know, they need supplies and they all just need this to stop because people are not only hurt already in hospitals, they're also getting attacked. El Ahli, the other day, I was in the north, and at 2 a.m. I was awoken by a huge blast because right down the street, the hospital was struck and it was destroyed. And it was one of the first hospitals in Gaza City. And it was really functional. And the hospitals are not functional overwhelmingly. Like, there is a genocide happening that's like a B-plot here, which is that not most of the hospitals, if not all of the hospitals, have had sustained damage and are operating on a percentage of their capacity.
Where are the doctors coming from? Who is actually administering treatment here?
I want to first and foremost say that local Gazan doctors are really at the forefront of all of this. And there have been doctors that have been working for 17 months, 18 months without pay. There are medical students who have been jumping in as doctors. Nurses are doctors. Like, everybody's all hands on deck. So places like GLIA rotate in emergency medical staff. They'll rotate as doctors every couple of weeks, maybe even twice a week. Maybe even, you know, just depends on what the need is, where the need is, and what we have available in the volunteer sort of rotation. Right now we have international supporting these local doctors and just going in and just either kind of helping them just literally do more work, or also kind of like refining processes and trying to like figure out what ways they can triage, et cetera. There's just, you know, different doctors have different specialties. Like, cardiologists are coming in with GLIA, anesthetists are coming in with GLIA, emergency room trauma doctors are coming in with GLIA, nursing, lactation consultants and maternal and NICU side sort of doctors are coming in. They're coming in from Spain and America and Tunisia and Jordan, and they're coming from a lot of places. There's not as many as we're coming, because I think Palestine, you know, struggles to, like, for 75 years, struggles to, like, capture people's sort of, like, sensitivity, but it finally has. And still, it's going on for so long. Sorry if I'm, like, a little intense. It's a bit intense here. But it's been going for so long that ultimately, It wanes, and people need help here. Like, advocacy should really be humanitarian in its scope. And I think we've done a really good job of being loud. But at this point, it's like, you know, the medical situation is dire, and we need people trying to come help if they can, and also if they have the means and a reason to.
So how do these rotations actually work? You said you have to leave after some time, but what is the mechanism of that?
But the rotation is usually a month. It's through the World Health Organization. You don't have to leave. I think that they expect 1 month, and, you know, you allot your time for 1 month, but then you come and you're like, everything has no meaning compared to this. Like, this is incredibly important for me to be doing this. And you get attached because you realize actually that it's a real situation that can be sort of assuaged in ways maybe not political, but in ways medical and in ways psychological and in ways literal food wise. Like, you literally can bring in cans of tuna and, you know, for yourself, even just so you don't literally take other people's food, and you're also paying, like, spending money in some way. It's hard because it's really hard to get in. And it's hard to know what to do for people, to, like, what they need to do, but it helps to know that it's a real situation, that one you can feel and, like, reach out and touch, like, you know, pass through paradigms and really figure out by either just talking to people who are here. You know, it will lead you the right path if you just talk to people, because that's how you get to know more information. And I just have spent a lot of time talking to Gazans, because I'm Lebanese and I speak Arabic, and there's a way to just basically connect and understand, instead of it being sort of fuzzy and far away. It's not far away. This is a situation that's really happening in real life, and not, we shouldn't care because it could happen to us, but we should care because it's happening to them already. But also, it's terrifying to imagine being in this situation.
Has anything in particular surprised you, or has anything stuck out to you? Again, the distance between watching it on our iPhones and then actually being there.
I think seeing grief out loud is very hard, because you realize a person is, like, losing their person, and that person's not coming back, and you're experiencing something that makes your ego die, and you realize these people have just been going through not only literal death, but they have also, like, there's an elevation of spirit because of it. And that makes everything in the world seem a little less hard. And it makes it seem important to grasp that nothing should be this hard, actually. And that maybe what we find hard is slowing us down from really helping people who are going through hard times. And also, I guess the fact that I'm trying to think, just like the beauty, the colors, the just hospitality, the ways in which Palestinians rib each other and rib you and like make you feel like you're a part of a family really quickly. And then you're like suddenly like being bullied and it's the, like, you know, it's funny. And you're just like, wait, like, how are you? You're just like so full of life that even now, like, I can't even outmaneuver you with just jokes. You know what I mean? And I think that stuff is hard to tell, but I think people are aware of it. I think Palestinian journalists have done a really good job of covering the situation. And because of that, I think we've all been compelled and like endeared to the people itself.
So this isn't going to, I mean, it might come off as trite and I don't mean it to be, but people listening to this are going to want to do something, you know, like at this point, so long into this terrible atrocity, what can people do? What should people do? I think it's important, like you've been underlining, to really emphasize the humanity here, that it's not just terror, it's not just horror, it's not just death, but there are people. But in addition to that, what can people do? How should people think about this? Those questions.
I think a lot of times we get brainwashed into thinking things are political or they're reactions or it's just violence. But I think that everything is profit driven, actually. And I think that the more we really think about what we're doing with our energy, whether it's financial energy or the energy that we have on a daily basis to talk about things that are important or to bring light to things, there's also this energy of action that I think is important. I think that's what we're getting at, is like, what can you literally do? I am just like everyone else. I don't have all the answers at all. I found a way to come here because that was just in my path, but it's not everybody's path to just like come to Gaza. Like, that's not easy. I think you have to find out what makes you, what your strength is in this world, and put it towards advocating for human rights. And in this particular situation, I think boycotting things is important. I think also being vocal is important, but actually reaching out to Gaza itself and talking to people is important, because you don't always have to help with just finances. Sometimes being there for someone and just saying, hey, listen, I'm far away from you, but I see you and I really want you to know that people care and I care, and I'm going to check in with you every other day because I just want to know that you have stories and I want to know about who you are and I want to know how I can find a solution for you, even if it's not me paying you, because I don't know how to do that. But there's a lot of psychological warmth you can bring to like this world. You know what I mean? And I think that we are all capable of that.
So Afif, before we go, is there anything else that you want to say just to people who are listening?
Yeah, if you can, donate to places like Glia, donate to places that you trust, that are actively helping people on the ground here get safety in whatever way that looks like. It could be places like Glia, or it could be literal families that just, you know, that you're paying to their GoFundMe, or it could be, you know, any sort of organization you trust, you know? I mean, just really think about your energy and how much you can spend it on new things or new ways to help this situation.
Afif, thank you. Beyond thank you for joining us. And I think I speak on behalf of humanity. thanking you for the incredible work that you're doing. Really, thank you so much.
Oh, I appreciate you having me on. And it would be nothing, honestly, without the local people here doing most of it. So I appreciate you having me on.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.